Then let me hit the, all right. Susie's hit the record. Perfect. And.
Right. Hello. Hello, everyone. This is Zach Coble. I'm the chairperson of the Commission on Disability Issues. I'd like to call this meeting to order at 3:32 p.m. on February 19th. Rick or Susanna, can you take roll call, please?
Okay. Kate Elliott? Sue Krager?
Here.
Derek Espadas?
Here.
Wedley Derbyshire?
Here.
Zach Coble?
Here.
Ray Jordan?
Here.
Lily Bogan?
Here.
And Jonathan Lee Confer?
Here.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, Rick. So the first item on the agenda is a call to the public. I think I saw maybe one person I did not recognize as being a part of CODI or that I knew was an employee of the city. But if there's a member of the public on the call that would like to speak to a disability issue in the community, now would be your time to do it. Please unmute yourself or raise your virtual hand, whichever is accessible for you. I'll be silent for a few moments. Jennifer, if you have something that you'd like to say, now would be the time. We can probably give you like about 3 minutes. We may not respond with an agenda item, but definitely love to hear what you'd like to say.
Good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Bonham. I'm with the City of Tucson. I just wanted to introduce myself. Rebecca Hill normally attended these meetings on behalf of the city manager's office. I'm filling in for Rebecca in an interim capacity since her retirement.
Great. Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you for introducing yourself. We really appreciate you filling in. And, I may reach out to you, depending on how long you stay as interim, I may reach out to you in the next couple of months to see what that role as interim of OEOP looks like. Thanks very much. So the next item on our agenda is a presentation and discussion of disability response training for Tucson police officers with PJ Dixon. PJ, I believe you're on the call, so if you'd like to mute yourself, introduce yourself, and, we can have a presentation and discussion, that'd be great.
Hello, everybody. I'm PJ Dixon. I'm the founder of Disability Response Training. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
All right. Excellent. Fantastic. So this is somewhat informal, but I'm open to any and I'm open to any questions either at the end or at any point in the presentation. So let me tell you just a little bit about myself. I have a rare form of muscular dystrophy. I was only expected to live until I was 7, actually. And I always make the joke that I turned 56 this year. So either I've got something good to do in the world, which I hope, or God's pissed and I have to work off my karma in some way. So I'm probably in trouble in some way. A little bit more about my background, just to give you some understanding of who I am. And I'll attempt to be brief. I've been speaking from stages since I was 7 years old. I have been training in martial arts almost 40 years, combat form of martial arts. I push a manual wheelchair. I play wheelchair sports. I started 4 wheelchair sports teams, 2 nonprofit organizations, and I've trained over 100 people with disabilities in self-defense practices here in Tucson as well as up in Phoenix. And I've taught martial arts in 5 different cities across the United States. I'm kind of an unusual disabled guy because even though I can't lift my arms or move my arms, I can move them a little bit, but it's always like using my back to fling my arms. I still am very interested in law enforcement and military tactics and things like that. So as a civilian, I've been trained in a lot of the different kinds of military tactics. I've also done active shooter assessments on local businesses in Tucson. The reason I tell you all of that is to give you a foundation of who I am in terms of the reason that the Tucson Police Department reached out to me. There's more in my background, but, you know, I think that gives you a solid foundation. So my team is made up of 4 disabled people. Two are amputees, and one they both use wheelchairs every once in a while or walk. And then another one has, another one of my teammates has, a spina bifida. And then I have another teammate who has a traumatic brain injury. And then we have 4 teammates that are able-bodied people, and they're all, 3 of them are former law enforcement officers from Phoenix. And one of them is an Arizona Ranger who is still active duty and still trains and works with South Tucson on a regular basis. So that's the background of my team. Now, why do I tell you all of that? Because for those who don't know, in 2021, in November of 2021, Tucson had another unfortunate shooting by a police officer that involved a physically disabled man. And 5 days later, I'm the one who got the call, and they said, "We think we have a gap in our training that you can fix." And I took that very seriously, because to me, that was a call to arms. That was an opportunity for me to help save lives and simultaneously create a greater awareness and connection between law enforcement and the disabled community. Gave me a chance to be an advocate for the disabled community, but it also gave me a chance to ensure that police officers felt comfortable with our community, because let's face it, a lot of times able-bodied people don't have disabled people in their life, and so they're not really always sure how to interact with them. And with police officers, since they might have to go hands-on, it might create an additional hesitation on occasion. So sorry if this is boring. I'm normally like, woo, my crazy speaker, and I feel like I'm very like clinical right now. I'm boring myself. All right. So I'm just going to turn on my normal personality, if that's okay, which is way more fun anyway for me. I was really honored to get that call. I'm just giving you the background. I built this program, Disability Response Training, which I originally called Successfully Interacting with Physically Disabled Suspects. It was a mouthful. People were like, wait, what does that mean? Disability Response Training, much easier for people to get. So it's built on the foundation of over 100 case studies that I have of unfortunate incidents between law enforcement and disabled people. And this isn't everything that's out there. These are just the physical disabilities that I've acquired. I still haven't collected everything that's out there. And as many of you may know, upwards of 50% of all encounters that law enforcement has is with someone that has some kind of disability. Now, arguably, it's usually mental or cognitive, but on occasion, it is physical. The thing is that physical disabilities and training for police officers dealing with people with physical disabilities, complete blind spot. There's nowhere else in the United States, there's nowhere else in the world that I've been able to find, or than any of the law enforcement officers that I've been working with in different capacities have been able to locate. So disability response training is a completely unique program built out of TPD's awareness that they had a gap. And so we've been so well received that TPD officers themselves are strongly suggesting that this needs to be spread out through the United States. So that's one of the things that we're doing, which I can talk to you about towards the end if you guys are interested. I have 35, almost 40 years of experience in just martial arts alone, as I mentioned earlier. And I know what I was going to say. Okay, I did that. Sorry, I'm just looking at my notes. Defensive tactics in police, within law enforcement, there's usually a position called defensive tactics or a director of defensive tactics. And so defensive tactics are the people that approve the hands-on techniques that are used for their officers to ensure that they're safe. And so the tactics that I've developed are real-world applications. Law enforcement has buy-in. Defensive tactics have given us a thumbs up, or two thumbs up, actually. So this is actually, realistically, this is a 10-hour course, but we squeeze it into 4 hours because it's so hard to get any kind of time with law enforcement because they're so heavily burdened with training already. So we really, if we could get 6 hours, we'd be primo. If we had 10 hours, it'd be amazing. But 4 hours, we're doing incredibly well. I'll talk to you about the rating system in a little bit. Okay, so this was a 28-month process. When they called me until the time that we actually got the contract, because the city got involved, the TPD and I were working well together. The city got involved because the city was in litigation with the family of the gentleman that they the off-duty officer shot. And so the county attorney suggested that instead of allowing TPDs to hire me directly, we needed to go through the procurement process. So we went through the entire procurement process, and I was selected out of everybody else who applied. My company was selected to do the training for TPD, which is a big honor. Okay, so let me talk about the curriculum. What am I teaching the cops? So first of all, I want you to understand that when they came to me, they said, hey, we want you to train everybody, not just police officers. I was training police officers, detectives, CSO, and I say was because yesterday was our last class, community service operators, what else, 911 dispatchers, everybody. We trained virtually every employee in Tucson Police Department since June until yesterday. So we're very, very proud of that. So I'm not teaching them new protocols. I'm not teaching them new I'm not trying to change anything that TPD already trains them in. We're just adding tools to their tool belt. And we make that abundantly clear in the training that here are some options for you, and here are the reasons those options exist, including when we go hands-on, which, again, I'll talk about in just a moment. I'm ahead of myself. So we break down the program into, in essence, into three basic parts. Familiarization with disabilities and mobility devices or mobility aids. And then we talked about control and cuffing. And then the third piece or the third component is lifting and searching. Unfortunately, we've only gotten to lifting one time and searching never because we just don't have enough time. But inside of the training, we're talking about familiarization with disabilities, including their mobility devices and mobility aids. We're talking about the strengths and weaknesses of different disabilities. We include invisible disabilities because even though they might be invisible in some cases, like deafness, I still constitute that as a physical disability. So, again, TPD and all police officers across the country get tons of training in cognitive and emotional disabilities, but they get nothing, absolutely zero, when it comes to addressing physical disabilities. In August of 2024, I don't know if any of you heard, Phoenix PD went hands-on with a guy that had cerebral palsy and was deaf. You know, so talking about how to interact with the deaf community is one of the things that I referenced very quickly in the initial conversation, because if somebody's not responding, I want the police officers to make an assumption that maybe this person is deaf. Maybe not an assumption, but just maybe we can approach this person with a little more patience in a different kind of way instead of going immediately hands-on. Let me see if I can capture their attention. So we go through several different ways that they can get the attention of somebody who may be deaf or, you know, ignoring them without actually going hands-on. So we have breakout sessions. We have three breakout groups. Initially, we talked about manual wheelchairs, and then we have a scooter section, and we have a power wheelchair section. Inside of the manual wheelchair section, we talk about crutches, and then when we come back together, after the three breakout sessions, we come back together and we have a whole section on prosthetics, how to interact with people that have prosthetics, how to remove prosthetics, if necessary, what not to do, like don't rip a prosthetic off, for example, because it can tear their skin. And, you know, we have a whole Q&A. They get to be hands-on with all of this. So we have lots of wheelchairs. We have two scooters. We have two motorized chairs that they get in. They drive around. They, you know, they spin. They, like, work on the cuffing and control with each other in there. They're pushing the manual wheelchairs. So they're on the crutches. They get hands on with everything and they love it. I mean, it's great, right? Because I could do a PowerPoint, which is almost in the entirety of all of their other training, or they could be hands on. They love it. In fact, we get comments that say, I've been a cop for 30 years. And I've never had this training. This is the best training I've had in 30 years. That's amazing. That makes my heart feel really good. It makes me know that we're doing the right thing. Okay, so we also talk about within there multiple ways of stopping their mobility device. For example, with an electric scooter or a power wheelchair, we've got something called the automatic brake release. So we teach them where that is, because had this on off-duty officer, and this is my personal opinion, had this off-duty officer had any kind of training like this, he would have known that he could have very easily disengaged the ABR, the automatic brake release, or probably engaged the automatic brake release. And when he did that, the chair would have either stopped or it would have just spun in a circle. The outcome would have been completely different. In my, again, my humble opinion, he could have also pulled the plug on the gentleman's wheelchair. You know, there were options that he had, but he just didn't know what they were. He had been completely uneducated. Was a fairly young officer. So we talk about, and they get to see those. So they get to see them. They get to go hands-on. They get to engage with them. We show them pictures of different places that the ABRs are so that they really get an understanding of where to look and what to look for. We have several hands-on activities to make sure that they know where everything is and how to use those. We show different types of manual wheelchairs. We show different types of brakes so they get an understanding of that. We give them a chance to actually disassemble the mobility devices so that, you know, because a lot of times, in fact, I just had 2 weeks ago, two classes ago, 1 week ago, we had somebody in our class that said, hey, I actually had an encounter with a disabled guy 2 weeks ago. And we're like, okay, well, tell us. And he said, you know, when we had to break down the chair, I was like, I don't know how we're going to break this thing down. I don't know what to do. And the other officer there, his partner, said, oh, I've been through PJ's class. I can do it. So that was great because that alleviated the tension and the stress and the concern and the worry about the mobility device because they understood it. So they're able to actually now, they literally leave. They could walk out the door and instantly engage completely differently with the disabled community. While we're not directly talking about kindness and patience and compassion, we really sneak that in through interaction with us, through hands-on with us, through conversation about de-escalation, covert conversation actually about de-escalation, which I'll talk about again briefly so I get ahead of myself. So let me come back. We talk about hiding places for weapons and drugs. And I also talk about service animals because I want to make sure that the person's animal is safe if the officer has to go hands-on. But I also want to make sure that the officer is safe from the service animal. So we also address that. Everything that I've built is either within the parameters of the ADA, Department of Justice, and what's it called? International Association of Police Chiefs, I think, IACP, or PC, I think. Chiefs of Police, I think it's IACP. And not just within the guidelines of that, it's supporting the requirements that these three agencies have for law enforcement when it comes to people with physical disabilities. So I also talk about an approach assessment. And I make a joke, I call it WALK, W-A-L-C. The W stands for, what do you notice when you walk up? Because every officer, when they walk up to a scene, they have an approach assessment. They're looking for, what's the scene look like? Is there anybody laying on the ground? Is anybody hurt? Do I see any weapons? Where are people's hands? How many people are here? What are the egress points? So officers have approach protocol. So I give them one called WALK. W stands for, what do you notice when you walk up that might indicate a physical or mental or emotional disability? What do you see? We cover different kinds of things to look for. We also talk about cerebral palsy in that same section. When people have restrictions in their ability to articulate clearly and how you can still communicate with them effectively, even if you can't necessarily understand them. This comes from a former student of mine who has a profound speech impairment from his CP. A stands for abilities check. So W is what do you notice that might indicate a disability? A is abilities check, top to bottom. What do their arms and hands look like and what are they doing? What does their body look like? How do they look like in terms of their balance? And then legs, are their legs doing anything? So I want the officers to actually really get a real assessment. C or L stands for look at the three C's. Control, how are you going to control that chair? Cuff, how are you going to cuff that particular suspect? And concealment, maybe cuffing because their wheelchair is really big. Concealment, where might they be concealing a weapon or any kind of contraband? And this is important because when we go hands-on, when we go hands-on to make sure that they understand that you actually have to take the person's balance to be able to ensure their safety, we give the officers, we put an officer in, and let's say the electric wheelchair, the power wheelchair, and to demonstrate the real need to ensure that the officer has control of their balance, we give the officer in the wheelchair a gun, a red gun, not a real gun, a training weapon. And I say, okay, where would you like to carry this? If you were in this wheelchair, where would you carry it? Inevitably, they put it under their leg. And what happens is when they successfully take the person's balance and they're still in control of them, the person in the chair is reaching for the ground for their balance. They're not reaching for the weapon. So we're keeping the police officers safe also. And by default, we're keeping the disabled person safe because the protocol for police officers, the moment they see lethal force weapon, gun or knife, is to create timing. They call it timing, distancing, and shield. So basically, they're going to back up and draw their weapon. That could go really, really bad for the disabled person. So ensuring that the officer has their balance right from the very start, is in control of the chair and has their balance right from the very start, is critical to ensure everyone's safety. And then the last C in WALC, W-A-L-C, is create or collaborate on a plan. If you're walking up to somebody with a disability, you see they have a dog, you notice what kind of mobility device they have, where are their ABRs, where are their automatic brake releases, do they have any brakes on their chair, what kind of chair is it, how big, how tall is the back, how wide is it, if, you know, am I going to have to use two pairs of cuffs to cuff them, will I probably have to cuff them to their chair, what are the different, you know, the different factors that they need to take into consideration, where am I going to stand, and this is a big thing that I talk about in terms of where they're going to stand. Because a lot of times officers, if I'm here, there'll be an officer diagonally here talking to me, an officer diagonally here talking to me. Well, if I'm here, at some point my neck starts to get, you know, starts to ache because I'm looking up. It doesn't feel so good. So the escalation, the agitation starts to rise. So I teach them to lower that escalation. So when they lower that escalation, then all of a sudden they have the ability to communicate with the disabled person in a different way, in a better way. So moving on, I did mention covert de-escalation training. The reason I say this is because TPD, when I first came to them, de-escalation was a component of, not even just really when I first came to them, but towards the end when we were finalizing everything, I went to them and I said, okay, here's what I'm going to teach. And they said, well, you could probably leave the de-escalation out because we get plenty of it. If you're a husband, you don't have enough de-escalation. If you're a wife, you don't have enough de-escalation. If you're a dad or mom, you don't have enough de-escalation. If you're a friend, you don't. We never, ever have enough de-escalation. So I covertly sneak that in there by helping them to really get comfortable and familiar with the disabled community. We make lots of jokes. I make jokes about them. I make jokes about us. And we really do a great job bringing them into the communication of how the disabled community communicates with each other, but also how they can communicate with us at the highest level of respect. And part of that is languaging. Part of that is not standing over here where it's stressing my neck. But when you realize, hey, would it be more comfortable if I stood in front of you? Is that easier on your neck? Wow, man, that's a lot easier. Thank you. So I really work on helping them to understand and see us as just real people, not just people with disabilities. And I make sure that we talk a little bit about dignity to treat us like the average person so our dignity is good, but also recognize the disability so that there's some compassion and patience and understanding there. All right, stay with me for just a few more minutes, okay? All right. So we also talk about the disability mindset, which is critical because we have a different kind of mindset. The way we see the world is completely different than the way they might see the world. So I really spend a lot of time helping them understand that by making sure that while they're in front of me, I have two cops in front of me, and I have them flank me, I have them move around me, and what I do is I speak what my nervous system is doing. So often what they'll do is they'll start to flank me, and I get this sensation like I instantly don't trust them. So I back up and I start to move around, and I'm like kind of looking left at the one on the left, looking at the one on the right, backing up, trying to make myself safe. Because I want them to realize they're lording over us. Not in a bad way. Just because they're taller than us, right? Because they're able-bodied, because they're physically stronger. So I talk about the psychology behind how we might perceive that and receive that. Part of that is I break it down into three categories. The upbeat and positive mindset of a disabled person. Somebody who might be struggling, number two, somebody might be struggling, but they're unwilling to quit, you know, and our heart really goes out to those kind of people. But those two aren't the kinds of people that the officers are dealing with. The officers are dealing with people that have disabled anger or arrogance. My term, disabled anger or arrogance. And I break it down into three categories. They have need to prove something. They have this sensation or this feeling of being untouchable, and they can sometimes be rather brazen. Now, again, we're not talking about the upbeat or positive. We're not talking about the stereotypical able-bodied or not able-bodied, physically disabled person. We're talking about a physically disabled suspect, which creates a slightly different mindset, slightly different frame. And then I talk about what I call three truths. Some disabled people are angry at the world. Some disabled people make everything about their disability, and some refuse any kind of help. And I do this because at the end of that, I say, look, I want to make sure that you realize, don't let them make you wrong, and don't let them make you angry because they're struggling. And so it gives me a chance to really talk about de-escalation a little bit more and establishing connection with a disabled person, because we have the option to de-escalate and create connection, or we're going to resort to use of force, which is probably going to be bad for everyone. So, and I tell some personal stories in here. I reference some of the case studies, the over 100 case studies that I have to demonstrate brazenness, the untouchable mindset. For example, you know, when I was in college, police officers were arresting a friend of mine who had quadriplegia, and I was giving the cops a hard time because I didn't think that they could arrest me. The one cop at some point, he stopped and he said, looked over at me and he said, "Hey man, do you want me to arrest you too?" And I was like, nope, because I didn't think that I could also be arrested. I thought I was untouchable because I'd gotten away with so much stuff as a disabled guy my whole life. So I use real life stories to help them understand some of the principles. And then, of course, we get into control and cuffing, which is really critical because they need to understand that. We do that in a breakout session also, so they get the control and cuffing in the with manual wheelchairs, with crutches, with scooters, and with motorized wheelchairs. Like I said before, we don't get to the lifting and the searching. We've only talked about lifting once or twice. We've never gotten fully or deeply into the searching. We talk about it and the familiarization about where they could be hiding things. So let me just cover, I actually have great stats, but I don't have the ability to get the stats on this, so I'll tell you the stats as I can remember them. So the number of attendees that we've had is close to the 1,000 employees, okay? Yesterday they said there were only 8 police officers who did not take our training. So that's pretty good. Only 8 cops weren't able to get into it. They've asked us to come back to train their police academy cadets sometimes between March and September. So that's exciting. We've trained, I don't know, close to the 200, if not all of the 200 other employees. The police chief has poked his head in, but he didn't get trained, and I was really disappointed. I was hoping he was going to go through the training also. But he poked his head in, and he said, "I'm only hearing amazing things about this class. Thank you. Keep it up." Okay? So I feel like that's really nice. So we've trained almost 1,000 employees, which is great. We currently have the police rating. Now, I haven't uploaded the last two classes, so we're not sure yet. But out of one being the worst class I've ever had, five being an amazing class, we're currently with patrol officers sitting at a 4.75. And that number is actually significantly higher when we can, well, I don't know if I'd say significantly, but it's higher when we take into consideration the non-sworn officers, because their rating is at 4.96. So that means out of five, we have somewhere right around a 4.8 stars out of five stars. I'd say that's pretty good, especially because we're getting a lot of police officers say, this is the best class we've ever had. This is the best training I've ever had. Where were you when I joined the force 30 years ago? So those are really, really nice comments. And the last class that we had, the average number of people in the class was supposed to be 35. TPD, let me rephrase that. The average number of people in the class that we were supposed to have was supposed to be 35. The city approved, they awarded me the contract, and then the city, then TPD came back and said, hey, why are you charging us this amount? And I said, well, this is what the contract says. And TPD said, well, that's not what we have. We only have this dollar amount. And I said, well, the city approved this. The city told me to apply for what I needed. And so we negotiated. They reduced the contract by 20%. They reduced the number of classes in the fee by 20%, but they increased the class sizes. So we went from 35 people in a class to yesterday we had 60. Most of the time we had right around 45 or 50. That's a lot of people to go hands-on. So because they reduced it, TPD didn't get the actual hands-on training that they needed at the level that I think they needed it. They got it. They did. We really worked our buns off to make sure all patrol officers got to go hands-on first. But when we had 60 people yesterday, we just couldn't get through everybody. It just wasn't possible. So we did the best that we possibly could for TPD. Last two things that I'll say, because I know that I'm running out of time. Two of my teammates are former police officers. One says the interaction with the disabled people will only pay off in the future for the city of Tucson. This training would have given knowledge to me in my career to aid me in communicating with this demographic. DRT, Disability Response Training, quickly allows officers to build a bond they would not have had before. It allows officers to skip the awkward phase of not knowing how to communicate with a group that they've never really been around before. The other officer said DRT, Disability Response Training, was groundbreaking research and training for the LEO, the law enforcement officer community, and TPD. This training helps erase the stigma that the disabled community is somehow less or untouchable within TPD and the general community. It was our honor to be part of this historical life-changing training. The general public will be better served because of TPD's new knowledge. Nowhere else in the world, as far as I've been able to find, do any officers have this until now. Tucson Police Department is the first department to ever get this training. We're planning on expanding. We're trying to get it mandated. Oh, thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate that. We're trying to get that mandated within Arizona Post Peace Officer Standardization and Training, which would mean all police officers are going to be required to have this in Arizona. There are 18,000 law enforcement agencies, nearly somewhere well over 300,000 police officers, or law enforcement officers that could be air marshal. And we are looking currently to expand into sheriffs, doing multi-department trainings. For example, South Tucson only has 17 police officers. So if we can combine South Tucson with Vail and Nogales and Sahuarita, Three Points, we might be able to get a regular sized class. So I'm going to stop here. I have hundreds of evaluation testimonials, but I think the fact that we have a rating of 4.8, at least 4.8 stars out of 5 from crusty cops that have 30 plus years of experience in some cases, I'd say we did pretty well. And I'm really proud of what our team has put together. So thank you for letting me be here. Do you guys have any questions?
Thank you, PJ. Thank you. I will let, if a couple members have questions, they're welcome to ask them. And then I may have a couple follow-up. I know we're running a little short on time, so I want to be respectful of your time, PJ, and the commission's time. So do you,
commissioners? Again, my apologies, everybody. I didn't expect
Oh, no worries. No worries at all. Wesley and then Sue.
I just have a quick question. How do you handle training for blind individuals? And I don't know how often police actually encounter and arrest fully blind people, but I was just imagining in my head that, you know, a blind person, if they're being walked away, usually we have a white cane, yep. You know, to guide us. So how's that handled? I'm just curious. Thanks.
So that's a great question, Wesley. We only briefly address it in the class to look for that, or to look for people that seem like maybe they're lost or they're not really like seeing things. And to just simply ask them, hey, are you visually impaired? Is there something that we can do to support you in some way? So we don't actually address the blind community as much as I would like just yet. The one way that I would like to teach them is that instead of grabbing the disabled person's arm or the blind person's arm, teach them that you put your arm out so that the blind person can grab your arm and follow you, so that there would be that level of comfort. But at this point, we don't do a whole lot with that, but I would love to hear any perspectives that you have and see what we can do to incorporate it moving forward.
Well, yeah, certainly that is our way, is to take the person's arm. Yeah. And if our stick is taken away, that then decreases our ability to navigate the surfaces in front of us. So that would also be a problem too. So just pointing those factors out about how blind people navigate the world.
No, I think that's absolutely beautiful, and I really appreciate that. We'll make sure that we bring the piece about the stick back in, especially because the stick really isn't that big of a weapon, right? Yeah. It's super flexible. So there shouldn't be a reason to take that away if the person is being moved from one location to another.
Yeah, that's my concern. Thanks.
Wesley, I really appreciate that. I promise you we'll cover that moving forward.
Sue, and then Jonathan.
Yes, thank you, PJ, for this presentation. I have a comment and a question. My comment is, it's a little, I don't know, shocking might be a little provocative, but shocking to hear that with all the incidences with the police, that they would think de-escalation isn't a hot topic. So that kind of leaves me feeling uncomfortable and nervous that they think they've attended to that. But anyway, that's my bias.
Let me respond to that just real quick. Okay. Their comment to me was, we get lots of de-escalation training, and defensive TPD, Tucson Police Department, is one of the best trained police departments in the United States. They're ranked like number 2 in training, I think. Okay. I agree with you 100%. Nobody ever has enough de-escalation training.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway, I obviously, like the rest of the public, have a lot of concerns about the police. But anyway, I'm curious, you talked about the gap, that the police department has a gap, and that you were called in to decrease that gap. What is the gap? What's their gap relative to disability?
Police departments are only receiving across the nation training in cognitive and emotional disabilities. They get absolutely zero training, again, across the United States and probably in the world, as far as I can see, in dealing with anyone with a physical disability. So I came in to fill the gap of training them on how to interact, successfully interact with physically disabled suspects and physically disabled people, and I make a distinction.
So do police get training just on, let's say, difference? I mean, it sort of amazes me that we have to address every little body, mind, skin color, sexual orientation difference with the police, but it seems like that's kind of what we do. Do they not get anything about how to define and conceptualize and respond to just difference? It seems like they're so quick to react.
Yeah, I often have the same sentiment. And the difference training that they get lots of cultural awareness training. And that's required and mandated, and they get it every year, even though it's the same stuff that they got the year before. For example, there was a Hispanic and I think Native American, I think they leaned into that a little bit, training in the first half of the day. So they go from 8 to 12 with that cultural training. And from 1 o'clock to 5 o'clock, I would come in, and teach, the disability response training. So they get that kind of cultural training. And the only other kind of difference training that they get is around mental and emotional disabilities that I'm aware of. As far as I'm aware, they don't get any kind of like how do we assess a person and see what their strengths and weaknesses are. I think the assumption is that most of the people that they're going to have to get involved with are going to be physically able-bodied in nature.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
And Sue, I can only answer that, Sue. I'm not a police officer. I haven't gone through the academy, so I can only answer that to the best of my ability. So it may be incomplete in the totality of the information. Okay.
Thanks, Jonathan. And then I think I'm going to cut it off there just because we have other agenda items.
Sure.
TJ, thank you so much. I appreciate you and appreciate what you're doing. Jonathan, if you have your question or,
Yeah, definitely. PJ, thanks for that talk. Aspects you were talking about. I think some of the stuff I heard was kind of like the knowledge-based stuff, like, hey, how do you put the brakes on the wheelchair? How do you look at different devices? Yeah. I think our empathy building, too, like, hey, I'm sitting in the wheelchair, go behind me. I feel nervous. I feel these things, really important things to have.
Yeah.
Have they gone through or has it been considered to have implicit bias training to kind of add on to this of kind of like what's their bias in terms of encountering somebody with a physical disability and how that kind of plays in with how they're going to react to a situation?
No, not as far as I'm aware. They might get it outside of us, but we don't have any, we don't have the time available to address any kind of bias like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for asking. I appreciate that.
Thank you, PJ. This was very informative. I'm glad you're doing this work, and I hope it is able to continue.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. All right, everybody. Is it okay if I leave now?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. If anybody has any questions, Zach has my contact information. You're absolutely more than welcome to reach out to me, or you can check out our website, disabilityresponsetraining.com. Okay?
Yeah. I will definitely share your contact information if people are interested on the call.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, everyone. I would like to go to our next agenda item, which is consideration and possible approval of the January 15th meeting minutes. Did people have changes or questions about those meeting minutes? If so, great, announce them. But if not, I would be looking for a motion to approve those minutes.
A motion to approve, Jonathan.
Thank you, Jonathan. Be looking for a second.
Commissioner Bogan, second.
Thank you, Lily. Rick, can you please call roll call?
Yes. Sue Krieger?
Aye.
Derek Espadas? Yeah, aye. Wesley Derbyshire?
Aye.
Zach Coble?
Aye.
Ray Jordan?
Aye.
Lily Bogan?
Aye.
Jonathan Lee Coffer?
Aye.
Motion passes 7-0.
Thank you, Rick. Okay, now on to our next agenda item, which is discussion and feedback of walkway accessibility with Jonathan leading. So, Jonathan, please feel free.
Hey, yeah, this is actually a very brief kind of thing. I was just kind of thinking that we might have an interesting opportunity to kind of have a discussion about. I'm currently working on some standards right now with ASTM. This kind of the American Society of Testing and Materials. They do a lot of kind of standard developments for safety. Some of these things being like, hey, you know, our buildings don't collapse because it's got a certain material that resists certain tensile strength. So we use these materials because it's science-based. We have the same thing for flooring too, where we say, hey, how can we make accessibility and flooring safe for public health? And one of the things we're currently doing right now is kind of redrafting standards from walkways to parking lots. And that's everything from inside the building to outside the building. And what I kind of was thinking was, if there's something that's missing in local Tucson codes, something that might be missing in ADA, it's possible for us to consider these things if there's something that you guys have opinions on in terms of pedestrian safety and accessibility that we can start putting into different standards and codes and hopefully getting it adopted in Tucson or amended to like ADA or amended to IBC or any other kind of standard within the city. So I was kind of just here to say, we're here to brainstorm. If you guys have any suggestions, I'm happy to take notes, bring it to the committee and present those as, I guess you could say, suggestions to consider for future standards. For us, what timelines that we're looking to get our standards done within a year or two, so we still have time, but the earlier we get stuff started, I'd be happy to pass on any suggestions you guys might have.
So are we talking about materials that, materials that would be used, Jonathan, or like actual, like spatial relationships between things? Like, I'm just like, in terms of like your role and the committee's role.
Definitely. Thanks for that clarification. That's important. Materials, I guess it could even be visibility. Like, do things need to be highlighted a certain way? Currently, like the ADA parking lots, they like have 96 inches for a spot, 60-inch gaps between parking spots for accessibility. We're looking at specifically things like even parking bollards to define a walkway in a parking lot so that if people are going through a parking lot, they can't get hit by a car. But really, it's kind of a wide open canvas in terms of the things we're looking at. It could be materials, the design of the walkways. It could be parking lots, wheel stops, bollards. It truly is an open canvas.
Okay.
It could be dimensions of things like, you know what, maybe the spots aren't adequate with how wide they are. There needs to be more. It's really, yeah, open.
Ray and then Wesley.
Well, thank you. Hi, it's Ray Jordan. Wow, this is a huge topic. Now, are we talking within the realm of a building and its associated car park and its own associated walkways? Are we talking about public sidewalks, the whole thing? Is that what you're looking at?
Yeah, right. It's everything. Inside buildings, outside buildings, abutting sidewalks, parking lots, you name the works. It's kind of a really big standard, and I can share the standard with you guys, but we're essentially taking a gigantic standard, breaking it up into a bunch of specific standards, and now kind of refining it. So it's really everything.
Yeah. So even parking spaces? Parking spaces?
Yeah.
Oh.
Cool. I have a little knowledge of the ADA, but I'm certainly by no means an expert, but we're talk about things like smooth transitions, pedestrian crossings where there isn't a huge bump at the transition between the asphalt of the road that the cars drive on and where the pedestrians step off. The materials that a sidewalk is used when a sidewalk is repaired, is it repaired correctly? When a sidewalk is repaired, does it duplicate the error that was made in the first place? For example, if there is a crosswise tilt on a footpath that's, I've just used the Australian terminology, sidewalk, that is more than the 1 in 50, I think, allowed. When a sidewalk is repaired, it really should be put back within the ADA standard, which means, that could possibly be a huge job, being much more expensive than what anybody thought in the first place. But there's all these sorts of things to consider. I think of myself in my wheelchair, but I think of people who can't see the sidewalks, can't see the transitions, can't see any definition between the bounds of a walkway and the nature beyond it, or the street beyond it, where the cars are at, or where the, I'm just brain dumping here. Electric cars that don't make any sound to somebody who isn't looking in that particular direction, they can sneak up on you and cause harm, even if you're not don't have a vision impairment. I think I'll stop there and let somebody else add.
Thanks, Ray. I saved some stuff and I wrote down all the stuff you were saying, so we can definitely talk about it in the future for sure.
Next, Wesley.
All right, so one of the things that's been on my mind, back in my hometown of Princeton, actually, they have, for the crosswalks, they use bricks, pavers in the crosswalks, which were really helpful for using a white cane. Not perfect, but helpful for using to cross the street with a white cane. Compared to just the asphalt road that the cars drive over, but was an identifying feature to represent where the crosswalk is. So my thought is some form of tactile crosswalk representation for a person using a white cane to get from one, street corner to the next, such as either the pavement lines or just going across the whole stripe. Such as they do in Princeton with the brick pavers. So that's one thing I wanted to point out. The other thing is, in the city of Tucson, unfortunately, there are not just one or two or three, but hundreds of intersections where the posts are not lined up properly with where the crosswalks are, which means that a blind person who is going to utilize the signaling, then expects that they're going to just walk forward and actually be at the handicapped route to cross the street. That's not the case in this town. And furthermore, to that extent, in several cases, there are instances where those posts are off the pavements to the point where a wheelchair can't even easily access it, or a blind person can't easily access it without actually leaving the pavement to get to the button, to push the button. So those are some of the examples that I know from a pedestrian side that I've noticed in traversing the city that I can think of at the moment. That's all that's coming to me at this time. Of course, finally, I'll just comment that for me as a blind user, really every darn intersection of this city should have audible, street signaling, which they don't. And that's just another, nitpick that I have. That's all I have at the moment.
Clarifying question, Wesley. Are you talking about stoplight posts? When you say that's when the crosswalk ends with a post, do you mean the
posts I'm talking about are the posts that hold the boxes where you push the button to activate the signal to say, hey, there's a pedestrian who wants to walk across the street.
Got it. Thanks.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. And those are the ones that are off pavement and, you know, in some cases they're wheelchair. You know, there's just odd situations around this town where there's raised curbs that would prevent, you know, a person from easily getting to it. You just have to start really going around the city. You'll just notice them as you go from place to place. And every intersection in this city is different. There is, if you want consistency, there is none here. That's really what I'm saying.
Got you know, it.
That's the short story. And to that end, I'll also say there's no consistency in the boxes that have been placed around the city either. You know, the audible mm-hmm. signaling boxes. They're all, not all, but they're different companies. Right? You know, so you get chirps out of one and beeps out of others and you know, walk and don't walk. And so, well, I don't know if you get the don't walk, but you get different voices out of some and you don't get no voices out of others. You get brrr out of some and, you know, it's just absurd. There's no, there's no consistency.
That's an important word in consistency because it also leads to expectations of how people are going to behave when they walk, which is what I think we're really getting at, which is the hazard. If there's not a consistency, you don't know what to expect when you're walking somewhere, which makes it dangerous.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Thank I mean, you. My dream was to actually have a four-way stop in the city for all pedestrians to walk, but I've stepped back from that. That's what they do in Princeton. It's an all-way stop and people now can cross across the intersection diagonally and such, but you know, it's a small town. Can't really do that here. I gave it a lot of thought. You know, maybe down on 4th Avenue, but nowhere else. All right, that's all I've got at the moment.
Appreciate the feedback, you guys.
I think the only other feedback I have initially is, like, if there was going to be, like, bricks or signifiers to blind or, you know, low-vision folks, in crosswalks, that those signifiers also need to be like flat enough and not like wouldn't move enough, you know, with earth movement to create hazards for mobility users as well, like mobility device users as well, because bricks can come up and then be difficult for things like scooters or walkers to navigate. Ray, I do see your hand up. Like I'll just mention that, you know, this seems like you all have some time to, you know, work on these standards. Jonathan, if other members of the, and Lily, I see your hand up as well. Offline, if we all have further comments, like I may, you all can email me and say you're interested in talking to Jonathan further about this if you have thoughts outside of the meeting. Because, like, I think this could be a very fruitful discussion that doesn't necessarily need to be part of our regular meeting, like, going forward all the time. So, Lily or, Ray and then Lily, sorry.
Thank you. Ray Jordan here. I'll be really quick. Tucson is a horrible place for pedestrians. Tripping hazards are everywhere. That is all.
Lily, if you have a comment,
yes, you can. Thank you. From my understanding, the ADA, what has been established from one city to another is that the truncated domes are what the tactile indicators are supposed to be on the crosswalks, which I've seen or felt in certain intersections, not in all, but isn't that what we typically use at crosswalks?
You're kind of like the little bumps you see, like on maybe like yellow or red, kind of on the slope where it connects the pavement to the sidewalk?
Exactly, where the slopes are, they're little domes. They're like half circles that lift up from the floor.
Yeah. I mean, those are there, you know, if the sidewalk is made correctly. But I mean, I think, you know, like what I understood Wesley saying was that, you know, that can be helpful initially when you're entering the intersection, but to follow the intersection, it would be helpful to have something tactile, throughout the crosswalk. So you stayed on the correct path.
Gotcha.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was saying.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Please reach out to me later, not for the meetings, but like outside of this, happy to meet outside of it for sure and discuss more when we have time. And yeah, we'll be happy to bring the stuff up. So.
Sure. I mean, I think I will probably have, you know, stuff to bring up when I have a little bit of time to like think and observe. Thank you, Jonathan, for bringing this to us, though. I really appreciate it.
It's super interesting. Definitely.
And encouraging.
One quick thing too, I put in IRB at the university to do a study on accessibility in Tucson, and the goal is to kind of interview people for an hour, kind of get a feedback on their experiences in Tucson, and I'd love to someday work with you guys outside of this, of course, and if you guys would be a part of it, kind of get interviewed there, and, you know, if we can get it published, that's great, and hopefully make some change in policy-wise.
Yeah, for sure. I like that. Everyone, if you want to be in touch with Jonathan and you don't have his direct email, email me and I will connect us so there's no quorum issues or anything of that going on. So just moving on to our next agenda item. I realized that, Rick, there might be I tried to update the meeting agenda after I found out, that the annual report needed to be done. I don't know if that got, I emailed it to you and Susanna on Saturday or Sunday along with the annual report, just because I didn't realize the annual report needed to be done before our next meeting. I don't know if that's currently on the agenda or we can approve the annual report.
If you did send it, I might have missed it.
I know there's a lot of stuff going on, so I just don't know how we want to approach the annual report.
We'll be fine to have it on the next meeting for the March. Okay. So okay. You're not going to be deemed or anything like that for submitting it, you know, after the date. It's just a date that they wanted to try to get everything in at one time.
Okay.
So there'll be other commissions too who have not submitted it or also will, you know, send it at a later date. So okay. I'll look for that email and I can go ahead and make sure that we have it for the next meeting.
Okay. I'll just include it in the next agenda. I was looking at the agenda to look at our next item and I was realizing that wasn't on there. So I know there's a lot of confusion back and forth. So no problem at all. I just wanted to make sure that we weren't going to be in violation or deemed for anything.
The commission will be fine. You'll be fine.
Okay. So next on the agenda, since we do have some time now, is discussion of the parks and recreation accessibility, possible opportunity to draft a memo. So I wanted to, before we kind of get into this, I wanted to, you know, just preface that, you know, we had our discussion, with Park and Recreation Head Lara Hamway last month. And I cut off the discussion, because we had other agenda items and I wanted to give an opportunity, to commissioners, who might have, you know, follow up to that or, you know, comments or issues that were going on, to, you know, voice kind of what was going on for them with parks and recreation. And then, you know, touch base on whether you wanted to draft a memo to mayor and council. So, if anyone has comments or follow up to that, you know, raise your hand, take yourself off mute, you know, that type of thing. So, Commissioner Ray.
Oh, thank you, Zach. Ray Jordan here. I may have mentioned at the previous meeting that I'm a regular attendee at the Aquatic Recreation Center at Reed Park, and I have an ongoing case, I guess you might call it, with the Director of Parks and Recreation, with the Office of Equal Opportunity Programs, with the ADA coordinator, and now with the City Attorney's Office, because currently Reed Park has no ADA compliant accessible pedestrian pathway from the perimeter, that is along the South 22nd Street, along the West Country Club Road, across the north, I've forgotten the street, it's a more minor street, and to the east is Randolph Way. There is no accessible pedestrian pathway to the zoo or to the Aquatic Recreation Center. That has been the case since they closed an accessible path that ran along Zoo Court. So that's been ongoing. That happened in the middle of last year, July or August. And I put in a complaint to the Office of Equal Opportunity at around about that time. Still ongoing, very frustrating. And what we're looking at now is how many other parks and recreation facilities have a similar problem. Something reminded me with our guest speaker today about training for employees of Tucson. You know, in that particular case was police officers. Training for the people who make these assessments. I was told by several different city employees that the pathways within Reed Park were accessible, but those assessments were made by people, able-bodied people who obviously have no training in such matters. And I've called them on it, and now we wait to see what kind of outcome eventually will happen. So sorry, that's my take on the whole thing. This is how it started in the first place. So we're looking at me personally taking action. When I say that, that sounds a bit serious. I'm not talking about legal action here. I'm trying to negotiate a settlement with the City of Tucson myself. So that's the personal thing. And in parallel, does the CODI wish to be a bit more general, not necessarily tackling the particular item on my personal agenda, in general looking at parks and recreation and saying, are you doing what you should be doing in terms of accessibility, both physical accessibility and the accessibility of the programs? And I know we heard from the director who said a lot of positive things about their programs. Sounds good to me, but the physical aspect of accessibility to me is still a bit of a problem.
Thank you, Ray. Sue?
Yeah, I just want to piggyback on that, Ray, because that's kind of what I was wondering too, is do we have, or has Parks and Recreation done any kind of an audit of their parks and facilities? I mean, is there a plan or at least a report on the status, accessibility status of their facilities? I didn't get that from her when she talked with us last week or last month, excuse me. And so, of course, you know, I don't know, but if there is something that we could look at, you know, that would be helpful. And if there isn't, then I'm wondering, why not? Why isn't there something?
So, Sue, I believe that Director Hamway identified, like, an old, I mean, those were her, I mean, I'm paraphrasing, but those were her intentions, you know, there was an older list that had been identified about a park's accessibility issue that came out well before her tenure, and that they had like a database of that, or they were inputting that information into a database. You know, I think we asked her to share that, and I don't know that she has reached out. She hasn't reached out to me. I did reply to her. I don't know that I specifically asked for that, but I did give her your and Wesley's information to follow up on some of the requests that you had related to maintenance at, I believe, one of the tennis courts you go to, and then Wesley about the accessibility of exercise equipment. I didn't hear anything.
Okay, so I must have missed that. So that was that on the facilities?
I just reached out to her directly and gave her your contact information, because I didn't want to create quorum issues.
The database. I don't remember.
It was on accessibility issues, but again, I think we, at the meeting, like, I asked, is that information publicly available? And she wasn't able to provide that. Mm-hmm. You know, and it could be, you know, that's in a program that's not really well designed for public use, and that the actual document, the original document, isn't accessible. I don't know. I mean, if it's really like, but the point is like, we asked for that. If we wrote a memo identifying that and other things, you know, we could ask that information be provided.
Okay. Yeah. So, because we don't even know what kind of markers, you know, they were looking at relative to access, right? I mean, because we've never seen it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, thanks.
So Ray, you had a comment.
Oh, I did. Thank you. In answer to Sue, and I have a partial answer that, it almost aligns with Zach's, that there was an inspection from the Federal Department of Justice, and I can't determine whether it was the result of a particular complaint, but it was from back in the 1990s. And that they developed a list of particular things right across the city. And there was a section that was about for parks and recreation. There was a section for other different city departments as well. And as far as I can determine, and based on last month's meeting, they are working through that 1990s list. I don't know whether there's anything newer being added to that list. And yes, I did find some stuff on the internet about it, but it was kind of sketchy information, and I'd really like to dig deeper.
What I think would be helpful at this point is if we agreed, if you know, a couple of us could draft a memo for review at next month's meeting, and then possibly, you know, vote to publish it. Ms. Bonham, did you have a comment? Hi.
And if you prefer, I'm also happy to ask informally if that database is publicly available in a format that is usable. I'm not sure what the answer will be, or
you know, assuming you all want to take that direction, I'm happy to pursue it just informally.
Sure. That would be great. I mean, I think, you know, if you're able to let us know if that, you know, if that information is usable for public or at least viewable to the public, that'd be great. I mean, given that there might be other issues, you know, identified at our prior meeting, like we may still work on a memo, but then we'd include that, oh, we have this information that would be very helpful to, you know, the public and the commission's work. I don't know if you have my email. You could probably reach out through Rick or Susanna to get that. And I'm happy to kind of respond for the commission if that's helpful, Ms. Bonham.
All right. I will let you know if I receive it.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. So were there volunteers for the memo possibility? If so, Ray?
Yeah.
Sue? Cool. And I'm happy to coordinate with you all about a memo. And then, you know, if we're able to get that data, that will be definitely reflected in a positive light, for sure. We may have that for next month. I'd like to move on just briefly. I had planned to maybe touch on this next month, but we can go ahead and touch on it now. So I just wanted to see Rick or Susanna if there had been an update from this, from the clerk or the city in terms of if Cody had permission or the ability to write press releases to announce meetings and or memorandum that we have offered. If not, that's fine. But, you know, I had just wanted to check in briefly about that, you know, so.
Yeah, I had went ahead and waiting for feedback for direction comments. I think they were also going to check with the attorney's office to make sure. But like you said, I haven't gotten a reply back. I had meant to call him this morning, follow up with an email, which I didn't, wasn't able to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll go ahead and after this meeting, remind myself to do it first thing in the morning, and then I'll reach back out to the group.
Okay, great. Thank you, Rick. No problem at all. I just wanted to, you know, give that a heads up. So now we'll move on to, our final agenda item and announcements. I have one announcement that's kind of just related to our business. So I was tasked with updating the Cody tracking document that tracks our progress and our work last month. I have not done so yet because I wasn't able to listen to the meeting audio before I needed to get things together. So I will have that for you all next month as well. But if there are, you know, disability-related happenings, events, occurrences going on in the next month, now would be a good time to announce them. So floor is, you know, please take yourself off mute or raise your hand or, you know. Commissioner Jordan or Ray?
Hello, this is Ray. I got an announcement. Yesterday, I was appointed to the Tucson Transit Advisory Committee. And this afternoon, I did the oath with Rick. And so apparently it's all official now. I'm having a bit of a guess. I don't know when my first meeting will be, but I think it's the first Monday of March, but I will, which means that when we have our next meeting, I shall be able to report back about what the Tucson Transit Advisory Committee does.
That's great. That's great news, Ray. I'm sure you'll be a welcome addition to that task force or committee. I forget the exact title of, like, I think it's a task force. Yeah, I'm very excited for you. And I'm assuming you are remaining on CODI, for the
task. Oh, yes, we did look into that, and we discovered that a person can serve on more than one. So we're all good.
Great. We wouldn't want to lose you from CODI. Awesome. Sue, and then I have one announcement as well that I didn't remember.
I just wanted to say that I was kind of late, but I have been kind of slogging through, what is it called, Plan Tucson or Tucson Plan. And Plan Tucson, yeah. And then, I came up with little, I didn't think anything real significant, but certainly some language issues I thought that made it difficult to understand what they were really talking about. So anyway, I started making a list, and then I reached out to them to see if I could do anything with it because I knew I had missed the deadline. And they informed me that there's going to be public hearings on March 12th and the 19th. And so, if we attend one of those meetings, then they would be interested in more comments, as I understand it. So there, if people are still interested in pursuing, kind of engagement with that plan, there is still opportunities.
Great. Thank you for that, Sue. I know I did make comments. I'm excited to see the new draft when it comes. And then I believe I actually have a couple announcements. There's a meeting at the Ward 2 office, I believe on March 6th at 10:30 on paratransit. And possible service options, for that, for Sunvan. For those who are interested, I would encourage, everyone to go. We'll be trying to reach out to Sunvan and, have, the director of SunTran or someone else, visit with us. The more meetings, the merrier, when it comes to advocacy. In maybe lighter news, I did receive an email about it last month. There is an art exhibit at the Mexican consulate, on Broadway in Alvernon. That's a tactile art exhibit, it's called Tactum, with a disabled artist and then I believe a Mexican artist. That's up through March 21st. That looked interesting. Just wanted to offer that as a point of culture. So, any other announcements?
I have a couple.
Sure.
So coming up next month is the annual fundraiser for Bailey Beats the Bite, which is a fundraiser, for Charcot-Marie Tooth research. It'll be held at Lambert Park. I will also, as part of their fundraiser, be thrown into a virtual jail on March 8th. So if you get a phone call from me, I need bail money. You can send that. I told them they might make more money by having people pay to keep me in jail. But, and also Differently Abled Entertainment over on Castro and Grant. They just continue to have different, events for people of all abilities. I will also be leading a, accessible yoga class, chair yoga class towards the end of March. So that is a venue that I'm on the board for,
and we're always seeking input as far as events. So it's a great, if anyone wants to be in charge of starting an event there, it's always welcomed. That's all I have.
Thank you, Derek. I appreciate those announcements. Anyone else in terms of announcements? Okay, I don't know that I see anyone. So I think we can call this, go to adjournment. We don't need a second or anything, Rick, right? Cool. Thank you so much, everyone. Really appreciate you all.
All right, time's 4:57. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Good night. Good night, Chris.
Yeah.